Election College, episode 288, Herbert Hoover.
Let's throw a political party. Face it, the political scene sucks, but did it always? It's time for Election College, and class is in session. Now, your hosts, Jason Goff and Ben Smith.
Hey, Ben, I probably should have said part one because there's a lot to say about Herbert Hoover. You know, he gets busted on by certain political figures in, you know, recent decades, but his legacy is much more than just the Great Depression. I don't want to give anything away, but
yeah, we don't want to be spoiling stuff from 70 years ago.
Man.
Yeah, he kind of has the, well, anytime we want to talk about some kind of system or political upheaval that we don't like now, we point back to that era. But at the time, it's undeniable that it was, well, I shouldn't say undeniable, it's almost positively that things were the right way to go. And you're right. There's a lot to talk about. Who knows? It might even end up being a three-parter.
Yeah. So Herbert Hoover, who was born in August of 1874 in West Branch, Iowa. And get this, Ben, he is the only president who was born in Iowa. Iowa being such an important state when it comes to politics. Uh-huh. And he's it.
That's probably the furthest west at that point.
Yeah. He's the only president at that point who was born west of the Mississippi. And his dad was Jesse Hoover. He was a blacksmith. And his mom, well, her name was Huldah, which, man.
That's a name.
It is a name.
Huldah.
And get this, she was from Canada.
Yeah. I was trying to think of the previous president we talked about whose parents were from other countries, besides like the first ones. I can't remember who they were now. Anyway, they were Quakers, and that's kind of the line that they came from. Of course, being from Ontario, his mother had a lot of English and Irish ancestry, and with that kind of comes that, well, Quaker religious outlook. And they were kind of a noteworthy family. Huldah had a big role in the church, and his father was just like a general businessman who everybody knew because you needed a blacksmith, you needed stuff for your farm. He was the guy you went to. And they passed away when he was about 9 years old or so. Well, his mother passed away when he was about 9 years old. And Herbert and his siblings, who he had some younger sisters, he had an older brother, they were put under the care of a fellow Quaker.
Yeah, good thing they were Quakers because they had some sort of support system. They stayed with one of his grandmothers there in Iowa. He lived there for about 18 months with his uncle, Alan. And then he was off to Newburgh, Oregon in November of 1885 to live with his other uncle, Dr. John Mendhorn. He was a physician and a businessman. And get this, he lost his own son the year before. And can imagine, you can't fill that void of losing your own child. But there, you have his nephew coming. And the Mendhorn household was known for their work ethic, and Herbert, even though he did work hard and, carried his weight, he was very unhappy. As you can imagine, it's really hard losing your parents and then not really having your place in the world, I guess is what you might want
right.
to say.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sing, but that's a difficult upbringing.
That's
really
a deep cut right there.
Yeah. But it's not until he enters Stanford University in 1891 where he really feels like, hey, he belongs here. But he was very much one of those scrappy people who, you know, you might have thought, well, what's he doing at this school? He failed all of his entrance exams except mathematics. And every other subject, he was hanging out there in Palo Alto, you know, having one of Zuckerberg's relatives, I'm sure.
Right.
Tutoring him.
Obviously.
The other stuff.
It's interesting because he didn't go to high school, but he went to night school during, you know, because he was working on the farm during that time. And he goes to night school and learns a bunch of stuff. And so you imagine he's self-taught and, you know, by the night school instructor. But students at this time, even in the 1890s, it wasn't always exactly typical for them to go to college or university. And for him to get there on a non-traditional education was quite the feat.
Yeah, so there he is at Stanford, and he's like, man, I cannot decide what I want to be when I grow up. And
me either.
Yeah, there's a position that opened up with geologist John Caspar Branner. He's like, hey, come here, Herbert. Get over here. Let me show you something. And I'm going to introduce you to the world of geology. And Hoover ends up interning for Branner and the United States Geological Survey during the summer. And Herbert, he was kind of shy and wasn't the guy who you would find at the frat house or sorority house, for that matter. And he still became the student treasurer.
His first election.
Yeah.
Well, first one he ever won that we know of.
And he was not trying to be political at all.
Right.
But, you know, his senior year rolls around and he's like, ooh, look at Lou Henry. And he's like, what am I going to do? I'm a poor boy. There's no way I can get married to that.
He needed no sympathy, though.
Lady. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he graduates in 1895. And he has a hard time finding a job because of the panic of 1893. But what ends up happening, or maybe we shouldn't jump too far forward, because this is kind of notorious about his life.
Yeah.
Should I say notorious or noteworthy?
Noteworthy, because notorious implies negative.
Yeah. So noteworthy about Hoover is he was the student manager of the baseball and football teams there at Stanford. Which goes to tell you about his athletic ability.
Right.
Probably. He was that guy on the sidelines.
Yeah.
Which is better than me.
Well, me too.
He was there at the inaugural big game versus the University of California. And get this, Ben, only 10,000 tickets were printed.
Which is still a lot of tickets.
Yeah. 20,000 people show up.
Oops. That's a bad and good thing to have happen.
Yeah. So they figured it out. But they had to find pots and bowls to try to collect admission fees. And Stanford won. And that game is going on, I guess, to this day.
Yeah. So after Herbert graduates, and I keep wanting to call him Hoover, but his name's Herbert. I'm sorry. I keep slipping back into it.
It's easier to say Hoover.
It is. After Hoover graduates, he goes to work in Nevada City. And in Grass Valley, California, for some gold mining. Craziness.
Gold in them there.
That's the time where there's some gold happening. And he ends up going and getting hired by another firm to be an engineer for the mines. And he ends up going to Western Australia in the late 1890s as part of this gold mining company. And in school, he had studied some serious geology, and he had switched his majors around a few times, but eventually settled in on geology and ends up really suiting him. And he's able to land this job and go to Australia working there. During this time, he really starts to have some political opinions, and not that he didn't have them before, but they become more apparent to him. He starts to really think about how workers' compensation is going to work, how minimum wage is going to work, and, hey, am I opposed to these things? Because they really do harm the owners of these companies, but at the same time, do they help the employees? So he's struggling or thinking through some of those things. He ends up getting promoted, and then he calls his college sweetheart, Lou Henry. And initially, when they were kind of in love in college, they kind of had to say, well, I guess we're not going to see each other any longer because we can't afford to get married. Well, at this time, he gets this promotion, and he can marry her now. So they get married. He comes back to the States to marry her for a little bit. They end up having a couple kids over the next few years, which we'll talk about potentially more in the future. And instead of going back to Australia, he's like, hey, we're going to go to China. And then he ends up going to China for work and takes along his wife at that time as well.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because his wife, Lou, she's like all about studying Mandarin Chinese. Which, what are you going to do when you're in China at the turn of the century other than learn Chinese?
I think that would be wise.
Yeah. So, by the way,
my brother-in-law lives in China. Uh-huh. He's lived there for like 4 or 5 years now. He doesn't speak a word of Chinese.
I'd just be pointing to things.
He teaches English.
Yeah.
But he doesn't speak Chinese. It's really interesting. I think it's a scam. I think he's in the FBI or something.
And here we are podcasting about it.
Well, I didn't say his name.
The entire world. They can figure it out because if the FBI is investigating.
That's right.
It's part of your file too.
Yeah.
So, but it is said that the Hoovers, they would speak a little bit of Chinese to each other. It's probably like how I speak French to my wife.
Oh, yeah.
It's not French, but she knows what I'm saying.
Right.
Which leads me to say one time when I used to work for the airline, there was a French person who came up to me and was like, you know, quel porte, you know, for what gate or what door.
Yeah.
And I tried to tell her, bay neuf, you know, for B9. And she kept on asking the question, which made me feel really bad because that meant
that you weren't saying it right.
Yeah. She wanted me to write it down. Oh. So I guess my accent wasn't good enough.
I guess not.
Anyway, so the Hoovers, they would speak to each other in code like that. They would, you know, be like.
Speaking in code.
Konnichiwa.
I don't think that's how that works. Speaking Chinese or Mandarin in China probably didn't work as well for secret code as it did in America, though.
You have a really good point.
Everybody else would know what they were saying. Oh, man. So anyway, while they're there, Herbert Hoover continues to notice all the different things that he likes and doesn't like about how employees are treated. And, you know, this is going to be a big piece of his presidency as well, some of those things that we'll talk about. And eventually, Hoover becomes an investor, a speculator, a financier. Pretty much anything that's kind of happening in the first part of the 20th century as far as mining and silver, lead, gold, zinc, etc., he's got a hand in. He's probably directing it in some sense or another. So he worked his way on up. That mathematics test he passed seems to have paid off, even though he failed everything else.
Yeah.
And he's become pretty successful during this time.
Yeah, by 1914, he's like, I can count to $4 million. So
That's like a lot, today's dollar.
Yeah, it's like almost a billion.
Yeah.
Is that
no.
right?
No. It's almost $100 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
$100 million.
Which still a lot of money.
When you get to $100 million, it's like a billion, whatever.
I feel like if you have $100 million, if you're worth $100 million, you have to try to lose it before you die. I don't understand how people. I mean, bad investments and stuff, I get, but people who just like waste their money like that.
Yeah, but not if you're Herbert Hoover.
That's right.
Yeah, it's said that like his mines, or not, I guess not his mines, but mines that he was invested in. I mean, some of them were. He had shares in, like, up until the year before he died.
Yeah.
Which he died pretty late, like 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I just gave it away that he died.
I have a feeling most people knew that, or at least guessed it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, when World War II begins in 1914, Herbert is really involved in some of the humanitarian work that's going around. He's leading a bunch of different volunteers to go and hand out food and clothing and, you know, just cold hard cash whenever about 120,000 Americans were brought home from Europe. And he's there whenever Belgium is facing a bit of a food crisis. He's there working in London, making sure that a bunch of victims of the war were getting fed. And he's just, you know, he's definitely doing the humanitarian work overtime at this point. And you would imagine that with him being worth as much money as he was, that he probably took a lot of that out of his own pocket.
Yeah. And you know what else he took a lot of? Heat.
Yeah.
From a lot of people who we all respect and love, like Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill didn't really care for Herbert Hoover. Yeah. he probably said his name something like that. He's like, dude, this guy is going in and he's feeding the enemy. And Hoover is like, hey, they're people. They need to eat. So even though after World War One, where, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution is going on and in Russia, it's becoming the Soviet Union, like, we wouldn't approve of that. But people are starving. And Hoover's like, you know what? These people need to eat. Here's some food. And the same with the post-war Germany. It was really rough. Hoover comes in, says, here's some food. And there is even a Platz named, I just like to say that,
yeah.
A place in like a town square in Belgium where they're like, hey, Hoover, Sprickensplatz, Platz. And they named it after him.
All the German speakers in the audience, they're like,
right,
what? They're like that lady at the airport gate.
Oh, man. She probably is still telling that story. Dumb American trying to speak French.
So, again, after the United States gets into the war in 1917, President Wilson says, hey, Herbert Hoover, you seem like you should be the head of the U.S. Food Administration. So, then he was. This, you know, had just been created. It was a new position. And there's some discrepancy about whether or not he was asked to fill the role or whether he begged to fill the role. But either way, he filled the role. And he was really of the opinion that food will win the war because, well, if you don't have food to eat, you can't, your troops can't fight. And if you do have food to eat, they're probably going to have at least a little better chance. So this is the point where he really actually gets into politics, strictly speaking. Even though he was really just still more about humanitarian efforts.
Yeah, people are like, is he a Democrat or a Republican?
Never know. You'll never know.
Yeah.
Actually, you will eventually know.
Yeah, there's so many themes throughout this. It's like, I don't know, Zachary Taylor's popping in my head. Like, people just didn't know what party he was. Eisenhower is same kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Maybe a more recent president, same thing.
Yeah.
So Republicans didn't like the fact that he was feeding people that we didn't agree with, like the Bolsheviks. But Hoover was like, 20 million people are starving. Whatever their politics, they should be fed. That seems reasonable. But maybe not. If you really hate a country or hate an ideology, they kind of lose their humanity.
Right. Yeah, and this is a little less history, but I guess it plays into history. The idea is if you starve the people, even, you know, the civilians, their military will feel that pressure and therefore, you know, relent, or the administration will relent in some aspects because their people are dying. But then there's also the idea that, well, we're not supposed to go in and harm civilians in war. So are we doing the same thing by restricting their food supply? So it becomes a very difficult thing for generals and high-ranking officials to maneuver based on, in World War II especially, because we can, you know, we could starve these people and their government will feel that pressure, but then we just committed war crimes without committing war crimes.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
It's pretty crazy.
It's pretty crazy. It's definitely, yeah.
When you think about it, yeah. Especially in this day and age where even when the United States invaded Iraq, they were still trying to drop food shipments into the people and so on.
Right.
Because it's the government you're trying to overthrow, not necessarily the people.
Right.
Speaking of overthrowing people,
ooh,
we're going to overthrow this podcast episode because I think we've been talking for a long time.
I was just getting so excited about military strategy.
Well,
I got carried away.
Cliffhanger, my friend.
That's right. Well, okay. So if you haven't yet, I honestly don't know what you could possibly be waiting for.
Because we're not going to send you food.
We're not. Or maybe we will.
It's possible.
Head on over to electioncollege.com/group and join us on Facebook. There's a group of people. Get it? A group?
Oh, that's what happens.
That's why it's called that. That likes Election College, or at least puts up with us. And occasionally somebody will chat or post something in the group, and we want you to come be a part of it. It's the least formal way you can chat with us or talk to some other fans of the show. And who knows, you might just meet your future spouse there. I just came up with that one just now.
Oh, I wonder, like, there's a Herbert and Lou romance.
Yeah, you never know.
Brewing.
Two history lovers get together in a Facebook group. Look, we don't need these dating apps. We just need Election College Facebook group.
Oh, man, I think you just gave me an idea. No.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, and while you're on the internet, because that's what kids are doing these days. They're all on the internet, and they're leaving ratings and reviews on podcasts that they like to listen to because they want other people just like them. You know, this is just like a circular cycle of, which I guess that's redundant.
Yeah.
Of humanity and goodness and spreading good cheer when you leave a rating and review. And hey, while you're leaving a rating and review, be thinking about this too. The other day I was driving my car and I was like, is it worth it? Is it worth doing Christmas sweater t-shirts this year?
Oh,
I don't know. Let us know. That might be a good topic.
We sold a few of them last year. We've even sold a few through this year. But, you know, if you guys want them, we'll do them. Yeah. But if you're not going to buy them, we're not.
It's a lot of work. We got other stuff to do.
Yeah. Like overthrow governments.
And feed people.
What did I say? Thanks, everybody, for checking out the show.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.